for our blind and print-impaired audience. Your North Carolina Reading Service today brings you the Indie Week. It's published on December the 1st, this issue, F-2022, and it's read by John Federson. And for those of you surprised a little bit by today's music, you all may not know that this is a very long composition, about an hour and a half to perform. So we very rarely get to hear anything but the beginning and the end in our show, and I asked our musicians today to perform a rarely heard section on our broadcast. As much as we can revisit in the future, we'll get to, and you are certainly welcome for the thrill. Well, I could listen to that for hours, and I might have to eventually, but let's get on to Indie Week. And we will begin from articles from the IndieWeek.com online version, sometimes which don't make it into the print edition. And this first one, originally published at North Carolina Policy Watch on November the 30th, says, celebrations tempered as state-level anti-LGBTQ bills loom. When the Respect for Marriage Act passed the U.S. Senate Tuesday, it did so with the support of North Carolina Senators Tom Tillis and Richard Burr, two of just 12 Republican senators to vote for the measure, which aims to be sure that same-sex marriage retains federal recognition. Tillis is in his second term, and Burr is retiring as the GOP wrestles with tension over LGBTQ issues, and the party is fueling a national tide of anti-LGBTQ bills in state legislatures. U.S. Representative Ted Budd, Republican of North Carolina, recently elected to Burr's Senate seat, has spoken at political rallies held by Christian nationalist groups that oppose same-sex marriage. The Respect for Marriage Act vote was driven by concern over the potential for a conservative majority on the Supreme Court to overturn Obergefell v. Hodges, a 2015 decision that established marriage equality as a constitutional right. Should decisions on marriage recognition return to the states, there's a strong chance marriage equality would be among the targets of a GOP majority in the General Assembly. Its numbers strengthened in this month's election that has for years pushed a series of anti-LGBTQ bills. 10 years ago, North Carolina was the last state to pass a same-sex marriage ban by statewide referendum. Amendment 1, which was approved by a margin of 61% to 39% in a primary election that featured a turnout of just 35%, was found unconstitutional in 2014 after Governor Roy Cooper, then the state's attorney general, declined to defend it in federal court. Since then, polls have consistently showed growing support for same-sex marriage and other LGBTQ protections. But Cooper's veto and the Democrats' ability to sustain it in the General Assembly was the only thing preventing some anti-LGBTQ bills from advancing at the state level. Republicans now need just one Democratic vote or absence to overcome Cooper's veto. For that reason, LGBTQ advocates are warning the Respect for Marriage Act doesn't go far enough. While ensuring marriage is legal in one state will be recognized across the country, it doesn't prevent states from turning back the clock to a period when same-sex couples can be married in some states but not others. Kendra Johnson, executive director of Equality NC, said in a statement on Tuesday, "Today's passage of the Respect for Marriage Act crucially codifies marriage equality for our communities. However, LGBTQ people deserve so much more. We need our legislators to pass comprehensive legislation which protects our communities, like the Equality and Fairness for All Act. Moreover, we need federal protections from the onslaught of hateful legislation and policy being enacted on the state level. The passage of the Respect for Marriage Act is a good step, but there's a massive gulf between where we are now and where we need to be. While marriage equality is an issue that increasingly divides Republicans, the party and its state lawmakers continue to fully back anti-transgender legislation from the local and state to the national level. On Tuesday, just across the border in Virginia, Republican state lawmakers filed Senate Bill 791, which would outlaw gender-affirming care for transgender youth and allow health insurance companies to decline coverage for this care for transgender people of any age. The bill is a version of the same anti-transgender legislation recently passed in Arkansas, now the subject of a federal lawsuit. Conservative activists and lawmakers have discussed similar bills in North Carolina and are actively pushing for them in the coming session. Next from IndyWeek.com, an article by Akia Dillon. Bradley, let's see, in Durham County Courtroom 7C recently, prosecutor Mary Darrow scans a docket of first appearances, bond hearings, and probation violations. Outside, a pair of black wedges and a plastic soda bottle sit forgotten in the hall. Inside, gallery members release yawns and stretch their limbs, earning a reprimand from the bailiff. Behind the defense table, a couple of inmates from the Durham County Jail slouch and await their turn in a pew of their own. Next up is the first appearance of Brentley Yancey, 34. Yancey, arrested 3 days earlier, has a short, tapered haircut and wears an orange jail jumpsuit. His charges include first-degree kidnapping, second-degree burglary, and conspiracy to commit murder. As he steps to the defense table, his shackles clatter. On this day in late September, the state accuses Yancey of being implicated in the disappearance and murder of Sean Burton, 44, a Durham father of six. The only issue is that Burton has not turned up, nor has his body. A murder without a body is unusual, so much so that such homicides hold a morbid fascination for some. There's an entire website devoted to these cases. Nationwide, they yield higher conviction rates than typical murders, but they also pose complex challenges for prosecutors. As a former federal prosecutor once told the Los Angeles Times, in a murder case, the body is the most significant piece of evidence. Darrow outlines the case. Sean Burton disappeared at March 22nd. That night, a Ring doorbell camera recorded Burton being held at gunpoint by the three masked men behind him. They forced him to unlock the building. When police arrived at the scene, they found it ransacked. There was also blood in the kitchen. Later, investigators found that Burton's car and two other vehicles traveled together from Durham to Henderson. Darrow says that this presumably is where the men disposed of Burton's body. Yancey and accomplices Darius Tyson and Tariq Henderson would later be identified from the camera footage. Over a month before this hearing, the state issued a warrant for Yancey's arrest. After the fact, Darrow says Yancey told witnesses that he was wanted and trying to hide. Darrow asks Judge Michael O. Fogluda to set Yancey's bond at $1 million. She explains why. Yancey has three prior convictions, including criminal street gang activity, discharging a firearm into occupied property, and intimidating a witness. She's particularly concerned about the latter. She says, matter-of-factly, he is a danger to the community and a flight risk. Ofogluda informs Yancey of his right to court-appointed counsel. Yancey rejects it. Instead, he will be represented by attorney Julian Hall, who sits to his right at the defense table. Hall stands swiftly, prepared to refute the prosecution claims. With a short black hair and a thick goatee, he insists the state has no substantial evidence and that they wrongly identified his client, saying, "This is all stemming from masked men caught in a Ring camera. Everything is allegedly. We do not have a body." Audience members sigh and mutter, irritated. Among them is a middle-aged woman dressed in scrubs. This afternoon is her second in court. She awaits her own first appearance. Still, Hall emphatically argues against the prosecution's negative portrayal of Yancey. He tells the court that Yancey is a veteran who, despite his criminal history, has turned his life around. Quote, I will tell the court that these matters are from 10 years ago. He has not been in trouble the past 5 years, except for minor traffic violations and marijuana possession. He explained that Yancey has shared custody of 3 young children. He has also enrolled in college classes and mentors at-risk youth. Hall requests an unsecured $1 million or secured $250,000 bond for his client. He addresses the state's remarks, dubbing Yancey a fugitive and a flight risk. The attorney says he was not on the run. He was traveling, visiting friends, and living his life. After the argument, O'Fodulia takes seconds to deliberate. Yancey sits still when the judge announces his bond will be $1.5 million. We will evaluate again after discovery, says the judge. And just like that, Darrow refocuses on the docket. Glancing down, she calls the next case. The bailiff ushers Yancey out the same door he entered through. Next, IndieWeek.com, and the last one, I believe, it's Giving Tuesday, it said, on Tuesday. 10 local nonprofits that deserve support, and we all know what the support means, that it's going to the end of the calendar year. It's the time if you're going to make tax-deductible contributions. Here are our picks for local nonprofits that deserve a financial boost this year. Number one, the Carolina Abortion Fund. With abortion risks at rights at risk in North Carolina and decimated elsewhere in much of the Southeast, consider making a donation to an organization that offers practical help to the people who need it. They give money directly to patients who need help covering medical expense, child care, and the cost of traveling, sometimes hundreds of miles, to get an abortion. Two, Democracy NC. You know all those complicated news stories about redistricting, voting rights, and the far right's efforts to destabilize democracy? Well, Democracy NC has been there for all of them, advocating for individual rights and educating people on critical political issues. This nonprofit is on the front lines of the fight for meaningful pro-democracy reform, keeping a close eye on election changes, voting rights, and public officials. Number three, El Centro Hispano directly represents the Hispanic, Latino, Latinx community in Wake, Durham, and Orange counties, which is composed of more than 170,000 people, according to U.S. Census data. In the past year, the organization has delivered food boxes to almost 2,000 people, diapers to almost 600 people, and COVID tests and information to nearly 29,000 people. They've helped teach people English and Spanish, helped them with utilities and rent payments, and helped many in the process of seeking United States citizenship. Next, Habit for Humanity. They don't just build homes. They also advocate for affordable housing. Recently, the Wake County branch of Habitat has partnered with the city of Raleigh to build affordable housing, helped preserve existing affordable apartments and homes, and has drawn attention to critical issues like rising property taxes and laws that disadvantage renters. Number five, CASA. Speaking of affordable housing, CASA has been hard at work in the midst of the housing crisis to give people shelter. This nonprofit builds and provides access to stable, affordable housing for people who are homeless or at risk of being homeless. Now, we've all heard of Meals on Wheels. They're another national organization that's doing impactful work locally in Durham, Raleigh, and Chapel Hill. Entirely volunteer-based, the organization drives meals to seniors who are homebound or having trouble getting around. This was a nonprofit was a critical resource to many during the COVID pandemic and has continued offering resources like meals, pet food, weekly phone calls, gifts, and basic necessities to seniors across the Triangle. Number seven on their list, North Carolina Conservation Network. It's a statewide environmental nonprofit that fights against climate change, for environmental justice, and to protect natural spaces. In 2021, the organization helped curb toxic discharge of forever chemicals. They set carbon reduction requirements for electrical companies, and they advocated for state climate and flood resilience funding, among other things. If you'd like your money to be used more directly, consider giving to the Triangle Land Conservancy, which buys private land for permanent conservation. Number 8 on the list, the Durham Crisis Response Center. The effort to stop sexual assault, domestic violence, and human trafficking is not a single battle. It's an ongoing war, which advocates have been fighting for decades. The Durham Crisis Response Center is the only organization in Durham, states its website, dedicated to providing advocacy, shelter, and support services to victims of domestic and sexual violence. Our ultimate goal is to ensure every victim is a survivor. Then we have number 9, the POOF Training and Event Center. Can't wait to see what that means. The acronym is not explained. Durham entrepreneur and mom, Destiny Alexander, provides a space for local teens to learn skills and trades that will allow them to start earning money and plan for their financial futures. Young people enrolled in this after-school program are encouraged to envision their short- and long-term goals, and they receive the resources, encouragement, and moral support that they need to go after them. The POOF, P-O-O-F, Training and Events Center. And finally, number 10 on this list, from IndieWeek's deserving nonprofits, Designed for Joy. Designed for Joy provides living wage work for women experiencing various crises, including refugees, domestic abuse and trafficking survivors, women leaving rehab or prison, and women experiencing homelessness or generation poverty. They're housed in Raleigh's Warehouse District. Designed for Joy sells handmade jewelry, bags and purses, other crafts and accessories, and provides stability, support, and immediate employment for women who need it. So many of these, which are not given on this article, are websites for all of these. So if you want to hear them again, you can visit this broadcast on our podcast section and listen for this first article about 10 deserving local gift places for your gift-giving dollars. Over now to the print edition of IndieWeek, called IndieWeek, and its first hard print article is from Leah Salvatierra from Chapel Hill, A Fight Endures. On an October day in 1997, housekeepers employed at UNC Chapel Hill gathered in front of the steps of Memorial Hall, protesting the university's failure to follow through with their hard-fought demands for a bargaining voice on campus and sustained audits of housekeepers' conditions and historical contributions to campus. More than two decades later, on an October day in 2022, housekeepers, student organizers, leaders from the university's workers' union, and other protesters returned to the steps of neighboring South Building. This time, they raised their voices with a renewed set of immediate demands: higher pay for an increased workload, free parking, meetings with the chancellor and administration to discuss these demands. These orders, delivered to the chancellor's office that same day, along with a petition, constitute a needs, not wants, list, says UNC housekeeper Tracy Hutter. It's yet another rendition in the long, visible struggle for workers and specifically housekeepers' rights at this university. UNC Black Student Movement Outreach Coordinator Joanne Obioma told the crowd, "We had this same conversation. There were people marching here the same way that we are, and we're still fighting for the same thing." Obioma emphasized that the story of labor organizing at UNC is inextricable from the larger black liberation movement and the university's history of racism toward those who built the school and continue to maintain it. Obiama said people don't understand and connect that workers' rights are black issues. The activism of UNC janitors, laundries, and cafeteria workers reaches back to the early 1940s and laid the foundation for the emergence of the mostly black, women-led UNC Housekeepers Association, HKA, in 1991. The main result of their organizing more than $1 million in back pay distributed to more than 400 of the housekeepers and groundskeepers is considered one of the greatest workers' rights and reparations of victories in the 20th century. Getting to this point was the result of a lengthy process of grievances and appeals. In 1991, the HKA organized after UNC denied the first two rounds of grievances through the university's internal dispute resolution and grievance process. The new organization moved forward with three main goals for its campaign: higher wages, fairer treatment, and beneficial training programs, according to one of their 1993 pamphlets. In that year, after the university denied the association its final grievance, the group filed a class action lawsuit charging racial discrimination. Their argument cited academic work to argue that the housekeeper supervisory system was reminiscent of the plantation system used during the university's construction by enslaved black workers. The complaint of residual systemic racism met nearly three more years of judicial appeals and denials when finally a judge asked HKA to reach a settlement. The HKA drafted a modest proposal addressed to the university's chancellor demanding the development of a housekeeper endowment fund, a one-time reparatory payment, free health and dental care for housekeepers and their families, and free tuitions to, quote, the designated heir of all black employees at UNC between 1793 and 1960, on top of back pay. On paper, the ultimate settlement achieved most of the initial goals of the campaign, including winning pay raises, one-time Christmas bonus payments, monthly meetings with the chancellor to meet, confer, and consider any changes proposed, career advancement, training programs, and the creation of two commissions. One was to look at the working conditions for housekeepers, and the other was to commemorate the historical contributions of black workers at the university. But then, like now, no mechanism existed to ensure that the terms of this settlement or any future agreements would be fulfilled. The university failed to arrange monthly meetings or initiate either of the commissions. So then, like now, the housekeepers returned to protest. The recurrence of this fight is mainly the result of a North Carolina law that prohibits employees and employers from signing a collective bargaining agreement, says president of the campus Y, Imani Rankins, who has been supporting the union. Enacted in 1959 by an all-white legislature, it is only one of two laws in the country that ban collective bargaining agreements for public employees and is considered the state's last vestige of the Jim Crow era. Rankins says, it's going to point to a larger issue if we want to stop having to continually have this fight every 25 to 30 years. We've got to get to the root issue, and that's the lack of worker rights in this state for public workers. That starts with the laws that deny collective bargaining for public workers. Dante Strobino, a union organizer with UE 150, says the statewide union was formed following the lead of the HKA and other groups in 1996 to push for accountability. The groups then merged to push for the university to meet the conditions of that settlement. More importantly, they set their sights on eliminating the ban on collective bargaining, as well as the state's right-to-work law, which effectively limits the organizing power of unions. Today, compounding demands that are still unfulfilled from the 1996 settlement is a renewed need for higher pay and a resolution over the cost of parking, which housekeepers pay for out of pocket. The October protest extended demands initiated during Housekeeping Appreciation Week of September, resulting in UNC housekeepers delivering 21 handwritten statements to their supervisor and Chancellor Kevin Guskowitz. UE150 began meeting with the housekeepers in late September to organize these demands, which were delivered on the day of the demonstration. During the protest, leaders from the Black Student Movement, Latinx Advocacy Group, Siembra NC, and the university's Social Justice Hub, Campus Y, prefaced speeches from the housekeepers, who condemned the university for increasing uncompensated work on the largely non-white workforce. UNC housekeeper Du Pao says, "A lot of nationality areas come to this area. Okay, very, very important. But we are housekeepers, feeling like they do not think about us, like housekeepers are nothing." Of the university's 294 permanently employed housekeepers, 95% identify as non-white, according to data from the university. During the rally, Harter said there are 5 open positions for housekeepers. She questioned where the dollars earmarked for salaries are being distributed. Quote, "They don't want to raise the pay for the raise in work." She described taking on additional responsibilities of being a floor tech and crew leader, in addition to her designated role as a housekeeper. "I might not have the college degree that you do, but I have some sense," she said. "I know where $150,000-something dollars is, and I know where it ain't." Harter emphasized that the movement must ensure that legislators, the UNC Board of Governors, and anyone in the university's administration who is responsible for the terms of their employment know that they mean business. On November the 3rd, university officials responded to some of the rising concerns in the university's monthly employee forum. But Strobino cautions that this forum does not hold the actual power of a union like UE150. Strobino says it's a space where the chancellor fundamentally has all the power. Chancellor can choose which issues they want to take up and which issues they do not want to take up. So the housekeepers and the union showed up again, this time in front of the Carolina Inn for the UNC Board of Trustees November meeting. Housekeeper Robin Lee, one of the leaders of the movement, was greeted by 2 members of the board and the chancellor, who accepted her and the other housekeepers' demands, the Daily Tar Heel reported. Lee was permitted to enter the meeting, where the board and the chancellor recognized the housekeepers' cause and discussed opening up communication with the groups, primarily the UNC Board of Governors, which determine the pay bands that set the wages for most university employees. But, just as in the 1990s, the housekeepers are in for a long fight while trying to balance their immediate needs, says Rankin. Quote, "The longer-term goal is getting those laws overturned, getting more rights for workers possibly codified into law permanently. But yeah, until then, we're going to continue to fight for the daily needs of our workers." Lee, who is known as Miss Robin, described her struggles to keep up with inflating prices. She said during the protest, "I've never been late on a house payment, and now I'm feeling about to lose my house." To support some of the housekeepers' families and checkbooks, UNC students rallied to fundraise during a basketball and volleyball tournament and a food drive this month, organized by the UNC Undergraduate Student Government Department of Civic Engagement and Outreach Services, known shortly as CEOS. CEO of Staffer, Lauren Taylor, says our best next step is to make it public to university leadership that students do care about this initiative, students do care about their housekeepers, and students will pay and spend their Friday evenings to show their care. Looking ahead, as they hope to fulfill their demands of meeting with the chancellor and eventually reaching the UNC Board of Governors, the union holds close both a history of struggle but also historic successes. Back at the protest, Strobino's shout rings loud. If they can get it then, we can do it now. Now, from Durham, Nate Hopkins' article, Hacking into History, begins with a quote. The lot hereby conveyed shall not be sold, transferred, conveyed, leased, or rented to persons of Negro blood. That's language taken from a 1932 deed for land in Duke Forest. Here's another from a plot off of Coal Mill Road. No person of any race other than the white race shall use or occupy any building on the above lot. These are racial covenants, racist restrictions, written into legally binding land deeds. They began to pop up in response to the 1917 U.S. Supreme Court case Buchanan versus Warley, in which the justices ruled that racially restrictive zoning laws violated the 14th Amendment. With local governments having lost the power to segregate housing, individuals decided to take matters into their own hands using racial covenants. Throughout the United States, these covenants targeted African Americans, the Irish, Jews, or anyone else considered to be an other. J.T. Tabron, an assistant register of deeds for Durham County, says these restrictive covenants were mechanisms to try to control the influence of these populations. In Durham, they were mainly targeted at people of African descent and concentrated in affluent white neighborhoods like Duke Forest or Hope Valley. Tabron is part of the Hacking into History team, a group dedicated to educating Durham residents about the history of these racial covenants. It started in 2019 when his teammate Alexandra Chazanoff began to wonder whether racial covenants were ever used in Durham. She's an assistant professor at NCCU School of Library and Information Services, and she says, I went down to the deeds office one day, pulled open a deed book, and pretty much right away found a deed with a racial covenant clause on it. Chazanoff started working with Tabron as well as John Killeen, a neighbor, and executive director of the nonprofit DataWorks. Their original idea was to host a community engagement workshop to raise awareness about the history of racist language in Durham land deeds. Part of the reason they are so dedicated to this cause is that these deeds have lingering effects. In 1948, the United States Supreme Court ruled that racially restrictive covenants violated the Constitution, but they were still routinely written into land deeds until the Fair Housing Act of 1968. While no new racial covenants could be written into deeds, those that already contained them were part of a permanent record. Prospective homeowners still run into them today. This brings up a psychological effect, says Tabron. You start to wonder if the people who live there now still feel that way. Aside from the psychological effects, those racial covenants also have contributed to the racial wealth gap. For decades, Black Americans were relegated to dilapidated neighborhoods, often close to railroad tracks, incinerators, and the like. Killeen cites the Brookings Institution's estimate of $156 billion in cumulative lost wealth for Black households due to racist practices. Quote, there's a long legacy of disinvestment and prevention of accumulating wealth through housing. Many have never heard of racial covenants, To combat this, groups across the nation are working to raise awareness that these racist restrictions and their modern implications, of which hacking into history is one. Unfortunately, the COVID-19 pandemic made their original idea of a community engagement workshop a bit more difficult to execute. Instead, they started moving in a different direction, a crowdsourced project to identify and map land tied to racial covenants in Durham. Documents in the Durham County Register of Deeds office were already digitized. All that was left was to isolate land deeds containing racist language. They started by using machine learning to identify about 4,000 documents containing key words like white, colored, or African. Machine learning isn't perfect, however. Deeds that mention White Street or Black Orchard Farm, for example, might have ended up in the mix. Chasanoff says, in order to actually confirm these deeds have a racial covenant, we needed human participation. Sifting through thousands of deeds would have been a daunting task for their small team, so they tuned to Zooniverse. That's a citizen science platform that allows anyone to get involved with research projects on topics ranging from steel pan drum vibrations to dark energy in space. So far, they've gotten about 250 volunteers involved and transcribed about half of their 4,000 documents. They aim to be done by summer of 2023. The team is currently working on a resolution for Durham City Council in the hopes that city planners and developers will take the historical housing patterns caused by racial covenants into account when planning new infrastructure. Tia Hall, the team's community facilitator and former member of Durham's Racial Equity Task Force, says, our hope is that people will have a better understanding of why Durham looks the way that it does and why there are communities that are in disrepair. With a full understanding, we can make decisions and movement around the development and building of our city. Next, Tomasi McDonald from Durham, empowering students. After a three-year absence, an initiative that helps children appreciate the importance of social justice and how they can make a difference in an increasingly racially polarized world, is set to return to Durham this summer. The Children's Defense Fund, that's CDF, Freedom Schools Program is a faith-based 6 weeks summer literacy and cultural enrichment offering aimed at empowering K-12 students, quote, to believe in their ability to make a difference in themselves, their families, communities, country, and the world with hope, education, and action, unquote, according to a press release last week from the nonprofit Durham Cares. It goes on, through reading and the idea that a person of faith can rally a community to understand the urgency and necessity of making a difference, we help children and youth change how they think about learning. The summer program is sponsored by the Mount Level Community Partnership for Racial Justice, a collaboration of several area churches and Durham Cares, whose members partnered in 2019, quote, to bring about racial justice in our community and our world through education, organizing, interrogation, examination of behaviors, beliefs, and practices of racism in our society, according to the release. The name, design, and purpose of the program were inspired by the iconic Freedom Schools that were created by the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee during that Freedom Summer in Mississippi in 1964. According to the website Civil Rights Teaching, the original Freedom Schools were intended to counter the sharecropper education received by a great many African Americans and poor whites. The website states, through reading, writing, arithmetic, history, and civics, participants received a progressive curriculum during a six-week summer program that was designed to prepare disenfranchised African Americans to become active political actors on their own behalf as voters, elected officials, and organizers. Nearly 40 Freedom Schools were established, serving close to 2,500 students, including parents and grandparents. Durham's Blacknall Memorial Presbyterian Church is one of the congregations that is participating in this racial justice partnership. David Dunderdale, an associate pastor with Blacknall, told Indy this week that it's important to give children hope and provide them with educational tools. Quote, "It's an important part of living out the gospel in our community. Freedom Schools gives our children an understanding of the world we live in. Our God cares about injustice and making it right. We want our children to know that God cares." The CDF Freedom Schools program in the Bull City was first funded by Durham Public Schools, DPS, and operated from 2013 through 2015 at Oak Grove, C.C. Spaulding, Bethesda, and Forest View Elementary Schools, says Denise Rousen, a CDF Freedom Schools spokeswoman. Quote, "The four different elementary schools we served had an academic need. We saw some very good results with reading, self-esteem, and confidence in learning during the program's first 3 years." After 2015, Rousen said DPS officials decided to no longer fund the program. She described it as a disheartening development because the Freedom Schools program garnered significant outcomes. Officials reported an 8-month increase in children's reading levels following the 6-week program. Rousen also pointed to the importance of parental involvement in the program and how children grew socially, emotionally, and academically. Public schools spokesman Chip Sudderth acknowledged that DPS worked with CDF Freedom Schools in the past and says the school system, quote, "is open to working with the program in the future." He wrote in an email to the Indy, "Our previous pause with the program came during a time of budget reduction and staff changes. We are continuing to evaluate partnership opportunities in alignment with our 2018-2023 strategic plan." The summer program will hire college students to work as counselors and mentors to the young participants, who are referred to as scholars. In addition to culturally enriching activities, there is a mental health component built into the program by keeping the youngsters engaged daily with civic issues and social justice, says Rousen. Along with themes like voter suppression, the children are asked about issues that take place in their communities, such as gun violence and bullying. Rousen says, "We talk about their ideas and how they can influence that. We don't have these types of conversations with our kids. Children know what's happening in their communities, and they have great ideas." The CDF Freedom Schools resumed locally in 2019 as a DPS partnership with North Carolina Central and Duke Universities, according to the press release. Rousen says the program was briefly housed at North Carolina Central, and the release stated, "Unfortunately, there has not been a Freedom Schools program in Durham for several years. The partnership understands the need of Durham children and youth to reap the benefit of this successful research-based program." Rousen says Charlotte has about 15 Freedom Schools, Greensboro has 7 or 8, Winston-Salem about 6, Durham and Raleigh have none. "My dream is that we have Freedom Schools in all 4 corners of Durham." The 2023 summer program will take place at the Hope Valley and Fayetteville Street Elementary Schools, says Rousen. Without DPS funding, the budget for the 2023 Summer Youth Initiative is weighing in at about $100,000, and its sponsors are looking for financial donations. And there's a short sidebar. Anyone interested in making a financial donation to the program can send a contribution here. Durham Cares, Post Office Box 331, Durham, North Carolina 27702. Checks should be made to Durham Cares / CDF Freedom Schools Fund. This is on checks. For additional information, please contact Denise Rousen at Denise M. Rousen, DeniseMRousen, Denise M. Rousen, at gmail.com. Well, we do have time for, I believe, a full music article this week. And this is written by Jordan Lawrence, and it's about the duo known as Violet Bell. They have a release party tomorrow, Friday, at least December 2nd, at 8 p.m. at the Cat's Cradle in Chapel Hill. As his name implies, writes Jordan Lawrence, Violet Bell's Shapeshifter is all about blurring rigid definitions. The song Sweet at the Center of the Chapel Hill Duo's pensive but passionate second full-length album, which tells the version of the Celtic myth of the Selkie, that's a seal-like creature compelled to assume human form and marry a fisherman, shifts through multiple perspectives as it finds the Selkie pulled by both the sea, her true home, where she can assume her true form, and her land-bound daughter, entrapped by her devotion to her child and the actions of a desperate and obsessive husband. I can feel your eyes on me. I can hear your mind on me, the Selkie shudders on I Am a Wolf, her anxiety expertly conjured by Lizzie Ross's strong but plaintive vocal. I'll never stop thinking about how to get free. With accompaniment that subtly but purposefully pushes the boundaries of Appalachian folk tradition, the suite grounds the record. Shapeshifter evokes both the internal struggle of those coming to terms with non-traditional identities and the outside perspectives that contribute to and amplify that trauma. Ross says over the phone from Boston, where Violet Bell was taking part in bassist Zach Hickman's power outage party residency, says, quote, the Selkie story itself is a story of otherness. It's a story of having to shrink one's identity into the acceptable space in order to survive, Ross says of the Selkie suite. True to that sentiment, while the experiences of those who have had their gender or sexual identities challenged or curtailed is the first and most obvious thematic layer at play on Shapeshifter, its exploration of how we define ourselves, how other people define us, and the expectations that come with those outside definitions pushes beyond this singular aspect. More refined, focused, and cohesive than 2019's Honey in My Heart, this album does the expected, tracing the Celtic roots that become part of the Appalachian music, and the less expected, bucking the notion that such traditional sounds belong to any singular group or can't mingle with other cultural hallmarks. Violet Bell finds kinship in their boldness with such adventurous North Carolina acts as Joe Troop, who contributes to this album, Rhiannon Giddens, and H.C. McIntyre, joining a growing swell of modern American artists who use the South's musical hallmarks to probe the region's complicated history and lingering prejudices. In an email suggesting topics of conversation for their chat with Indie Week, the duo put a fine point on their position in this regard, quote, being queer, black, indigenous, Latinx, and female in the often white boys club of bluegrass adjacent North Carolina music / Americana. Woo. The way their music fights against that boys' club codification feels both intentional and organic, Ross says. And Ruiz Lopez, her partner in life and music, who takes the lead on composing it, emphasizes the way his journey from Panama, where he was born, to Puerto Rico, and eventually North Carolina, contributes to the freshness of Violet Bell's sound. And he explains, I grew up listening to Latin American folk from the Caribbean through my father, as well as salsa in Colombia and bachata merengue. He didn't experience rock until he came across Jimi Hendrix at 14, and bluegrass didn't cross his radar until 12 years ago, when he moved to the Tar Heel State and experienced in person at a concert featuring Town Mountain and Bobby Britt. And he says, those sounds, that is just fresh to me. And I feel like this album is a combination of Lizzie and I's experience with those traditions and melding it together. Helped by a lively assemblage of similar-minded musicians, the Shop Shapeshifter proceeds through metamorphoses that, while never being really stark, bring new and distinct energy to familiar texture. And these other musicians are, at various places, Tatiana Hargreaves, Joe Troop, Joseph Terrell, Libby Rodenbaugh, Sinclair Palmer, Austin McCall, Joe McPhail, Ken Stewart, and Mario Inez. Ethereal, drone-leading fiddle enhances the blue-bounding bluegrass rollick of All the Stars, sending its determined optimism soaring through the twilight. I don't need no telescope to see there's no velvet rope keeping us from where we're going when we fly away. The treatment of the instruments on Fish to Catch blurs the line between what's electric and what's acoustic, heightening the unease of intersecting worlds as the sulky suite opens, its protagonist bemoaning how the chill never leaves my fingers and the damp never leaves my bones. Equally impressive is the way Ross convincingly occupies the album's evolving moods. She's the primary singer throughout. During the suite, she not only takes the role of the selkie, but also the rapaciously self-centered fisherman and a more benevolent and empathetic admirer of the fisherman's daughter. The first verse of I Am a Wolf finds Ross, who takes the lead on writing Violet Bell's words, mirroring the phrasing she sings as the selkie, instilling the fisherman's, I can feel her eyes on me, I can hear her mind on me, with urgency and emptiness. Fisherman's Daughter, the record's other truly boisterous tune, finds the admirer heaping keenly perceptive praise upon the titular offspring. Moves like wind, laughs like water, mind just like a wild nor'easter. But unlike the fishermen, they accept that the daughter isn't something they can own. Ross sings, love is strong, but the sea is stronger. Some hearts were made to wander. As the music reflects Ruiz Lopez's experiences, Ross' complicated lyrical themes have personal roots, she says. As a girl, as a kid growing up, I found my gender identity somewhere between, I'm not going to say poles, because I don't think it's linear, but beyond the subscribed boundaries of what qualifies as feminine. Her adolescence was split between Maryland, where her mom lived, and New York City, where her dad lived before. She came to North Carolina at 18, and she continues, and as a kid, we don't necessarily have the language or the agency to identify and name that. We just have these somatic perceptions. And as I began to understand myself in the eyes of the culture as a woman and what that meant and how certain slices of the culture perceived my value or my selfhood, there is a reckoning with realizing that a culture sees you as less than the ideal standard. The album's final song, Junkie, cuts to the quick of Ross's perspective here, stripping the instrumentation to just Violet Bell as an acoustic duo. She takes stock of people's crutches be they sugar or weed or something else. Reflecting on how maybe what we are truly hungry for is understanding. She simmers, some say we're born, some says we're made. Don't know how, but I got this way. And that, in the end, may be what the album is most about. The importance of coming to terms with the feelings and needs that make us who we are. She opines, on some level, I feel like the fisherman could be analogous to the ego or the hungry ghost, that grasping part of the self that's afraid and never satisfied and so deeply wants to be loved but doesn't really know how to receive that. The solution, she goes on, is not to condemn that part of the self or try to split ourselves into pieces and shove that little orphan splinter into the shadows. In order to function, we have to find a way to integrate and be in an active relationship with that part of ourselves. And once again, this is about a shapeshifter release party, which is Friday, December 2nd at Cat's Cradle, 8 p.m., Violet Bell and their release, Shapeshifter. And I can see that I have exhausted pretty much most of my time available now for Indie and the Independent Indie Week and IndieWeek.com. So I'll just close now by saying that this issue, as all of our issues, this can be found at the ncreadingservice.org as a podcast. Our first broadcast of the thing will be on Friday afternoon, December the 2nd. And for the rest, and if you want to rehear, particularly those article about where to donate some money to deserving nonprofits, you can find it there after the initial play of the broadcast. And so I don't have actually time to read many of the upcoming events. It looks to be like a reasonably good weather forecast for the weekend. There probably are still some Christmas activities you can get to and participate in, even outdoors, over the next day or two. And so I urge you to do that. And now we'll let our musicians continue on with their exploration of our theme music, and we'll be back next week, John Federson, for Indie Week. Bye-bye.